Welcome to Here in L.A., Silver Lake Edition. Today we talk with L.A. Times legend, Steve Padilla. Steve started writing at the Times in 1987. 10 years later, he was part of the Pulitzer-winning North Hollywood coverage in 1997. He has been a column one editor for the paper for the last 5 years. Steve's a USC Trojan, a native of Alhambra. He loves words, sentence structure, the flow of narrative, and is one of the most talented editors a writer could ever hope for to make their copy sing. We're very lucky to have him here today. So please welcome Steve Padilla. Hey, everybody. I am here in Silver Lake with Steve Padilla. Hey!
Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Please hold down the applause, please.
Steve, if you don't know, is a Los Angeles Times legend. He is the column one editor for the last 5 years.
That's correct.
You have edited and written on many, many desks. Do you want to list all the desks you've written for?
Oh, I think that would bore everyone. But yeah, I have done local news. I've done state news. I've edited presidential campaign coverage. Too many disasters to count, including one we're going through right now. And I've been at the paper, believe it or not, 37 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
Were you in the Orange County edition, the Valley edition?
I was in the Valley edition of Dear Departed Memory. It no longer exists, but we had an office in Chatsworth. And so I started in September of 1987. And I guess what's maybe most memorable for... So you need to know what I did. I was then covered what we called night cops. So basically focused on police. And I came in at 2 and stayed till 10 or 11, whatever, right? And so if back in, let's say, 88, 87, you read these like 8-inch items about a horrible car crash or a fire in the San Fernando Valley area, that was my work. I'm sure you all remember it. But more noticeable
well,
was...
the police blotter, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, the police blotter. Uh-huh. You know. But also big stories, too. But what was, I think, the most memorable thing for me is who my compatriot was on the cop beat.
Who would that be?
Michael Connelly.
The great author.
The great author, as in Harry Bosch, the Lincoln lawyer, and all that.
Wow.
So Mike started about 3 months before I did. So I guess summer of 87.
Uh-huh.
He came from a newspaper in Florida, and I'm blanking on which one it was. But and I came up from the San Diego Union. Oh. And so what was happening was, as I remember, we were getting beat a lot on cop stories by the Daily News. Our competitor.
Well, that was what they're supposed to be specialized in.
In bingo, yeah. And so we were told to stop that. And I think I can say we did.
Stop being beat.
Stopping getting beaten, yeah.
Right.
That we were on top of things. But what's really cool is, can I tell you about how, about the birth of Harry Bosch?
Sure.
Okay. So that is Mike's signature character. One of actually several he's created since then, right? And what was really interesting was there was this big cafeteria at the Valley Edition, and the staff would often gather, we'd pull tables together and just talk, you know. And so Mike, one day, who's actually in person, very quiet, by the way, he's very, very quiet, and he often at these lunches would just sit and listen and really not speak up much. And then finally one day he says, by the way, everybody, so my book's coming out next week. And we're like, book? We didn't know. No one knew that Mike was working on a book. And it was like, well, what kind? We're thinking nonfiction, you know, something like that. And he says, no, it's a novel. Novel? Yeah, what? Well, it's about this police detective. And he didn't tell us the name, but we're like, wow, that's great. Congratulations. Okay, so it comes out. That was The Black Echo, was
wow.
The first book, which won the Edgar Award, which is a major award for mystery writing, right?
Right off the bat.
Yeah. And but what was really interesting about that experience for me was I always knew that authors incorporate their own lives in their fiction.
Yeah.
Right? You know, Hemingway writes in his first book, writes about an ambulance driver, right?
Yeah.
Which book was that? That's the one where it's set in World War I.
Sun Also Rises.
Sun Also Rises, yes. That's right. And, and then other thing, you know, other example, what's one I love? J.K. Rowling, you know, her birthday is the same birthday as Harry Potter's.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's her birthday. Okay, anyway. So Mike writes The Black Echo. I read The Black Echo. I'm just stunned. My God, I'm so proud of him, you know, in awe. And then I start seeing things that, I go, I recognize this. So, for example, at the time, in the Valley, there was an arsonist running around setting fire to salons. Now, I'm forgetting if it was nail salons or hair salons. It was one of the two. But let's just say, for argument's sake, say it was hair salons. Mm-hmm. Well, in The Black Echo, there's an arsonist doing nail salons.
Uh-huh.
So he flips it. Okay.
Right.
There's a reference in that book to the at a police station, the bridal suite. Now, the bridal suite is an actual thing, or was a thing. I don't know if they still do this or not. But back then, at the Foothill Division, the division that brought you Rodney King, by the way, the Rodney King beating,
yes,
there was a kind of a utility room. It's like a storage room that they turned into like a bunk, because where guys, where officers, because women as well as men, they could just bed down for the night rather than drive home. And the reason was, back then, so many cops lived in the Antelope Valley, because that was the only place they could afford to buy homes.
Really?
Yeah. So there was a whole bunch of cops living out in, you know, Lancaster, Palmdale area.
Huh.
And the trouble was, they might work a late shift and then have to testify in court. And, you know, court starts often very early. So rather than make the drive, they would just stay at the station and sleep in this, you know, improvised room, you know, improvised, you know, where there was a cot and everything.
Yeah.
Anyway, they called it the bridal suite.
Uh-huh.
And there was, I think, a piece of paper that said bridal suite taped to the door.
Yeah.
That appears in the in Mike's book.
Wow.
But one, the last one that I'll just mention that I really enjoyed was there's a character in the book, I think it's a lieutenant, who has this weird habit. Mike describes how he would lean back in his chair and hold a long wooden eraser and just kind of wave it around like a baton. Our editor did that.
Who's that editor?
A guy who's passed away, a guy named Charles Carter was his name.
Interesting.
And Charles would lean back in his chair, often put his foot up on the desk.
Wow.
And he would lean back and he'd just wave this this wooden ruler around. It was just this habit he had. And so it was so fascinating to me to read this in Mike's book.
Yeah.
And to go, okay, I've seen that. Yeah, I know where he got this.
Yeah.
So it was just a, you know, if we're looking at like how storytelling comes about,
mm-hmm.
How you see how people use their own lives for the creative process, you know.
Isn't this what we were all taught as kids, though? Write what you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And so in a way, instead of putting it on character A, you put it on character B because mm-hmm. it gives them some panache or something.
Right, but you know, interesting thing about you, write what you know. I can see everyone uses that, whether, you know, intentionally, maybe unintentionally as well as intentionally, mm-hmm. right? But the writer, the woman who wrote Brokeback Mountain, Annie Proulx,
mm-hmm.
she says that that's the dumbest advice ever.
What, excuse me?
Yeah, she does. I forget the exact quote, but she just thinks it's the most cliche, tired advice, write what you know.
Yeah.
She says, if you only write what you know, you'll never grow. So she, so she argues that, yeah, I mean, yes, we'll draw upon ourselves whether we think we are or not.
Yeah.
But that if you research and explore other worlds, you will grow as a person, but I think also as an artist and a writer. But yeah, that's her comment, that she thinks that's terrible advice, where other people always say, write what you know. But you know, interesting thing, how we use in journalism nonfiction techniques, or you know, I can mention a connection to a linkage to Brokeback Mountain. Okay, I'll try to be concise about this. It was an amazing story written many years ago. It ran as a column one. This is before I was actually column one editor, but we would offer them up to the column one editor for, you know, to take it or not.
Who's the boss then?
Then it was, I'm pretty sure it was Roger Smith, who was the editor
God
at the time.
God bless Roger.
And just one of the classiest gentlemen and editors I've ever worked with.
Yeah.
So Jocelyn wrote this piece about a reunion. There was this woman, a white woman, who basically adopted a black woman. The older was like in her 50s, and the younger was like in her, you know, late 20s, early 30s, something like that. Mm-hmm. And they did this while they were, you know, in the 50-something, 30-something. They actually met when the black woman was a teenager, okay? And she was, I believe, an orphan and would just go from group home to group home and wandering mm-hmm. around and was looking for, you know, companionship and a home. Okay, so how does Brokeback Mountain figure into this? In the book, in this story that Jocelyn wrote, a recurring image is that of a blue dress. And the young woman has this memory when she was a kid, because she had all sorts of abusive relationships when she was a kid. She had this memory of a blue dress and someone giving her this blue dress, and it was a real sign of kindness. But then she began to question her own memories. Did the blue dress really exist? Was there really a blue dress? And so we mentioned this up high. Up high in the story, there's a mention of the blue dress, and then there's a second mention of the dress, just to make sure the readers don't forget that blue dress. Okay, so we just plop that in there. But we don't put a giant spotlight on the blue dress, but the dress is in there, okay? Yes. Okay, later in the story, about three quarters of the way through the story, the black woman and the white woman are reunited, okay? And the white woman shares with her photos she had saved from when they first met, when the black woman was a teenager, a girl. And there's a picture of the girl wearing the blue dress. And when we bring in the blue dress, and it's, my God, the memory was, it was not a false memory. This really did happen. That dress really did mean, you know, something. Okay. So when you read it, I mean, it just, you gasp.
Right.
Okay. Now, how does this affect, now, where does Annie Proulx come in? When Jocelyn was telling me all about this thing and telling me about the blue dress, and I said, oh my God, we're going to use this like the shirts in Brokeback Mountain. Remember, there's the two cowboys.
Yep.
And one gets killed, one gets murdered, you know. And his lover goes into his closet and he sees this, one of his own shirts, which he thought had just been lost in the laundry a gazillion years earlier. His shirt is there in his lover's closet on a hanger. But even more so, it is literally attached to one of his lover's shirts. He put the arms of one down the other. So she has this beautiful description talking about how but the two had become one. And so the symbolism of this shirt and what it meant and the love of it. And that shirt plays a role earlier in the story. There's a time where they get into a fight and they get bloody, and that's the shirt. It's a bloodied shirt. So anyway, just this power of this shirt, of an image. And I told her, I said, we're going to use the blue dress like the shirts in Brokeback Mountain. And I'm all excited about it. And she's like, what are you talking about? You know, but that is how it comes across in the story.
And I think this is something that a lot of people, by the way, there's going to be some people who are going to be totally turned off by all this. Mm-hmm. Fine. Screw it. You're missing out, people. Steve is a legend, and rarely does journalism get talked about in this way.
Well, it's not just journalism. I mean, and we're talking about that, but I think also this is about storytelling, you know.
Yes.
And I think, you know, yes, we report the news, you know, well, kind of what we do, you know, newspaper, right? But I think that some of the better journalism is informed by our own experiences.
Yes.
You know, and there is this stereotype you see in movies and TV and stuff like that of the hard-as-nails journalist, you know, who, you know, will do anything for a story and screw people over and that kind of thing.
That's right.
You know, that really is not true.
No.
Not on this side
of the pond.
No. Yeah, exactly. A lot of the best journalists I know, I think, cry at movies. Okay.
Right.
I think there's a great line I love from, I mentioned this to Jim Rainey the other day because of a piece we were working on. A wonderful line by Robert Frost. And he says, no tears in the writer, no tears in the reader. No tears in the writer, no tears in the reader.
Oh, if there's no.
Yeah. So in other words, it's okay if the writer is going to cry and react to something.
Yes.
And that's a good thing because that's what will happen with the reader. No tears in the writer, no tears in the reader. So when I've heard journalists say, well, you know, I'm supposed to be objective and be, you know, states, can I really, you know, feel for this person? You know, yeah, you can.
Right.
Now, there's a difference between advocacy versus reporting.
That's right.
All right. Okay. But
which a lot of very important people don't understand.
Right. And a lot of there's kind of a new generation of journalists that don't understand that either.
Oh, is it really?
Honest. Yeah.
Oh, no.
There
well, for
is
example,
this sense, yeah.
I voted for the mayor,
mm-hmm.
and I'm pissed at her for some things.
Yeah.
Just like I'm a Cub fan.
Yeah.
Sometimes the Cubs screw it up.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Why is it that we are so comfortable saying our team blew it, mm-hmm. but when it comes to politicians or other things, we have a hard time.
Well, in many ways, I mean, we are supposed to stay on the sidelines for certain things, you know.
Right.
And I have definite feelings about political characters.
Yes.
That I can't say. I can't say here. That, you know, I can't give money to political campaigns. That is forbidden.
Yes. Okay. In fact, we're going to go real deep now.
Yeah.
What I learned, by the way, listeners, I had the pleasure of working with Steve for about 3.5 years at the LA Times, mm-hmm. and it was absolute joy. Mm-hmm. In part because it was like grad school for me. It was the journalism school that I always wanted. Yet when I was younger and I wanted to go to J school, all of the professionals said, just write. Mm-hmm. Writing is a lot better than going to school. And so I felt like that 3.5 years at the LA Times was school. And one of the things that I learned in school there was a lot of writers don't even vote.
Yeah, I don't agree with that. And I know there's some people who feel they can't register with a political party, that they should register independent.
Yeah. If they're covering that stuff.
Yeah, yeah. But we can't make donations to political campaigns.
Yeah.
I mean, it's forbidden.
Yeah.
And I think one thing that has happened with social media is you'll see a lot of journalists from around the country, not just the Times, all over, who frankly are tweeting, posting things that I think cross the line, that really say, hey, I think this about, you know, Mitt Romney, or I think this about Trump. I think this about Kamala Harris, you know.
Yeah.
And I just can't go there, you know.
Because those people are covering these people.
Well, even if they're not covering them, they shouldn't if they're covering them. I mean, but even if they're not covering them, they shouldn't stay away from that. That's
because it looks poorly on the paper as a whole.
I think it looks poorly on paper. It looks poorly on them, and you never know. Okay, so let's say you say, let's say you're a local reporter here in LA, and you have a gripe with Karen Bass, and you wanna, and you say, I don't cover City Hall. You know, hey, I cover television.
Okay.
Okay. And
Robert Lloyd is pissed at the mayor.
Yeah. And, you know, so tweets off on about the mayor. Well, you never know as a journalist when you're going to be tapped. What if you have that writer who only covers television and everyone else is sick and there's a major event at the mayor's office and they say, hey, Fred, can you go cover the press conference?
Yes.
You never know. That could happen.
Good point.
When 9/11 hit, all those years ago now, in 2001, did you know that it was covered by just a ton of LA Times reporters? We did have a New York bureau at the time.
Yeah.
So they descended on it, of course. But and people ran up from the Washington bureau. Mm-hmm. And there also was an LA Times editor who I know was interviewing for a job in Pennsylvania. So she drove to Manhattan and helped cover it. But As I recall, that's the time of year when you have the tennis tournament, the U.S. Open. There was a sports writer in town. There also is a big thing. Is it called Fashion Week?
Yeah.
The big fashion thing in New York?
Don't pretend like you don't know about Fashion Week.
But that's the proper name, right?
Yes.
That's the Fashion Week, right?
Yes.
Okay, so we had one, maybe two arts or culture writers in New York for Fashion
Booth
Week.
Booth and Adam, was it, were there?
No, it wasn't Adam.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't Adam Shorn. I'm blanking on his name.
That's
but
okay.
Anyway, what happened was the two culture writers and the sports writers helped cover 9/11.
Yeah.
Because fundamentally, it's the same thing.
Yes.
Accuracy, fairness, concise reporting, you know, talking to people, getting the facts. Now, I know there's a bit of a difference between a baseball game or a tennis match and an act by Congress. But fundamentally, it is the same thing when it comes to what our responsibilities are as journalists. So that's why you had the sports writer and the fashion writers covering 9/11 for us all those years ago.
And we probably saw this during the Northridge quakes.
Oh, yeah.
And we might be seeing a little bit of it here in the fires.
We're seeing it right now. I mean, as we talk, we're 1 week out since the horrible wildfires, decimated Altadena and Pacific Palisades. Mm-hmm. And so what's happening now is it's kind of like the way we covered the COVID pandemic. During COVID, everyone at the paper covered it. Whether you were in arts, sports, business, metro, foreign, everyone covered the pandemic. And what's happening now is everyone is covering the wildfires. But you mentioned the Northridge earthquake. Can I share a memory
of course
about that relates to how that kind of reflects how we relate to our readers or they relate to us. And I think that there are corollaries to this happening now online. This is a print-centric memory, okay, folks? This is before the internet. This is when the paper would just arrive, you know, that flap on your driveway. So the day after the quake, the LA Times still came out, although our printing presses were just knocked out of commission in the Valley.
Oh, were they?
You know, yeah. But we had presses downtown, and we had a printing press back then in Orange County, too. Our circulation was much, much larger back then. This is before the internet, right? So the other two presses took care of, you know, printing extra copies. And so what happened is the next morning, the day after the quake, people are, and I have to remember this, people are terrified. They're either still in their houses, scared, or they're sleeping in their cars in their driveways, or maybe they've set up pup tents on their lawns, mm-hmm. right? And everyone's still freaked out. And yet that next morning, whap, the LA Times landed on their driveway. And for days, weeks, months, even years later, I heard from Valley readers who said, when that whap, when that paper hit the driveway, it was the most comforting sound. It was a sign that, okay, we're coming back. Things are already getting back in order. Yes. And I've always remembered that. And that's been 30 some odd years now.
Anyway. I'm choking up because I was in Atwater Village at the time and a house full of people who loved newspapers. And we got it too that day and the rest of the week.
The actual physical paper. I mean, we've had these photos on the front page that are six columns across. Pages are divided into columns, okay, basic. And there are six, it goes across six. And these photos, I mean, sometimes you'll see a four-column photo, five-column photo. We've had these six-column photos with these banner headlines just been jaw-dropping, just extraordinary.
By the way, I love that there's banner headlines.
Yeah.
Because the Times tends to be a little bit more conservative on mm-hmm. how they present stuff.
Yeah.
And people can quibble about that. I'd prefer a little bit more liveliness, but whatever it is, it is. Mm-hmm. And but finally, it's a six column headline.
Yeah, the six column headline, you know, and the six column photo is just a thing of beauty, you know.
Yeah.
As long as we're talking disasters, I want to bring up or disaster coverage. Let's talk about a rather remarkable essay. I really want to call it an essay more than an article.
Okay.
That my colleague James Rainey, we call him Jim Rainey, wrote for us the other day. It ran in column one, and it was my honor, and I'm not overstating that, to edit this piece. Because what I think is interesting about this, because you sent me a note saying you wanted to talk about this story, right? Mm-hmm. And this is an example, again, even if you're not a journalist out there, folks, for anyone who's a storyteller, how you can use your own life and experiences to inform things. And if you are an editor, director, that kind of person, this is where your own knowledge prompts you to ask certain questions. And those questions lead to things. Okay, so let me summarize the story. So Jim is from Malibu, grew up there, and he wrote this first-person piece reflecting on what it was like to grow up in Malibu and just saying it was, this is the 70s, okay? And he's talking about it was a simpler time. You know, it wasn't just celebrity, okay, and liposuction, right, you know, and influencers. And it's a beautiful piece. And he, it's just kind of going down memory lane. But I said, you know, this can't just be memory lane. There's got to be some larger point here. And he gets at that talking to a longtime resident from Malibu. And this guy basically says something very revealing. He says, you know, Malibu, despite our efforts, is always somewhat wild, and we really can never tame it. And so that's a kind of a cool thing. And that was the original end of the whole story. But then something happened. Jim made a video. We had a videographer with him while Jim, and you need to know Jim's house, I forgot to say, Jim's house was burned down. Okay, no one lived there anymore. His parents had both passed away, and they were getting ready to sell it. But his childhood home was burned down. So we videotaped him going to the place, and he starts talking about the most ordinary things and how wonderful they were. He's going off on like an orange tree.
We've got this orange tree over here, which is still barely surviving. That tree has probably been here about 80 years, maybe more. It's incredibly prolific, and the reason it's got so many oranges on it is because we've got a septic system right under it. So it's thriving off the sewage of the Rainey family.
And I'm watching this videotape, And I said, my God, he sounds like Emily in the last scene of Our Town. Now, if you remember Our Town, and many, probably millions of you were in it in high school, because I was, right? You know, every high school does it, as well they should. It's a classic. Mm-hmm. In Our Town, you know, one of the things it really gets at is how human beings don't really pay attention to what's going on around them, how we don't appreciate the beauty of things and the love around us. And Emily is this young woman who dies in childbirth, and she's dead, and she talks to the narrator of the show, known as the stage manager. And she says, you can go back among the living, can't you? And he says, yeah. And so she says, okay, I want to go back for one day. And all the other dead people are telling her, don't do it, don't do it. You're not going to like this. She insists, and she goes back, and she sees Mom making breakfast, and she hears her dad and all this. And she's just growing increasingly distressed because no one is looking at each other. We're just going through our daily lives. And there's this immortal line in the script where Emily just cries out, Oh, Earth, you're too beautiful for anybody to realize you. And so I'm thinking of that while watching Jim with his orange tree in Malibu.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing you need to know, I know this is going on, folks, but there's a payoff here, that his dad was a very successful actor. His name was Ford Rainey, and he had quite a career in theater as well as in TV and movies. You Google him. You'll see. You'll recognize him. He's one of those guys you see the face, and you go, oh, yeah, that guy. So he talked in this essay about his dad's, you know, acting career. And so I say, so after I watched the you know, Jim as Emily in Our Town, you know, in this essay, I say, Jim, did your dad ever play the stage manager? And he goes, yeah. Yeah, he played the stage manager. I've got the script right here. Now, this is just incredible. This has happened. He had been cleaning out the house, thinking of it for sale, right? And he had, like, I heard him rummaging. And just like in seconds, he produces his dad's notated script to Our Town.
So crazy.
Oh, my God. And so I'm thinking, wow, we should end the story with Emily's soliloquy, you know, and oh, Earth, you're too wonderful for anyone to realize you. But then as we're talking, it comes out that the stage manager actually has this soliloquy where he talks about what is essentially important, or as he says, eternal in life. And so Jim's, now I don't have a script, but I'm Googling it, right? You know, mm-hmm. And I'm finding the part. And Jim's got the script, and I hear him leafing through it, and he finds this. So so Jim writes a coda to this essay that I think takes it to another level. Can I share it?
Absolutely.
Okay. So this is so you gotta know, folks, that he's described, you know, what it was like growing up in Malibu, and then he talks to this old timer who says, you know, that you're never gonna tame Malibu, you know, we're just kind of visitors here. I think he says, it turns out we're all just renters here. This is the way that guy describes it, this long time dude in Malibu. And these are the last little bits, sentences that Jim wrote. And this is Jim's voice here now. In one of my last visits to the house before the fires, I found my dad's well-worn script of Our Town. His part as the stage manager had been marked with abundant thoughts in the margins. My mother had kept the Thornton Wilder classic and written a tribute just below the title to, quote, my love, my one and only love. How fitting, then, that my friend Steve, that's me, I'll admit, okay. How fitting, then, that my friend Steve recalled the stage manager's most eloquent soliloquy, quote, we all know that something is eternal, and it ain't houses, and it ain't names, and it ain't Earth, and it ain't even the stars, it goes in part. Everybody knows in their bones that something is eternal, and that something has to do with human beings. There is something way down deep that's eternal about every human being.
Very good.
And that's the end of the story.
Now,
my God.
You're probably too humble to connect these dots, but we wouldn't have that quote if you hadn't mentioned to Jim, your writer.
Exactly.
But see, I think this is what people miss out about the sausage making.
Oh, yeah.
There's a dynamic between the editor and the writers.
Yeah.
And the colleagues. Like you don't, you'll never come across as some angry, mean boss with a white shirt. You know, you might wear the white shirt, but you're our friend in the office.
Ideally, yeah. You know, I mean, Edna Buchanan, the crime writer, Pulitzer winner, and novelist, famously said, never trust an editor, never trust an editor, never trust an editor, right? I mean, But I think ideally, the way I like to describe it is that I'm Esa Pekka. No, I'm Gustavo Dudamel in front of the L.A. Phil, and I'm just waving my hands.
Yeah.
Okay, they got to make the music.
That's true.
But I'm the one who can say, more oboe, less cello.
There you go.
You know? And so in this instance, I did not write that ending, but I was an enabler.
You planted the seed.
I planted the seed. And then Jim handled that. In fact, I really thought that he would end it with Emily's comment, and he was the one who very correctly zeroed in on the, oh my God, we all know that something is eternal. And this is what I couldn't, when I found it online and we're talking together, I'd totally forgotten that he says, and it ain't houses, Jesus. And we've just lost these houses.
Unbelievable.
And it ain't houses, and it ain't names, and it ain't the earth, and it ain't even the stars. And Jim and I are getting like damn near teary-eyed on the phone about this, okay? Yeah. You know, and realize that is fundamentally what this story is about. And what's been so fulfilling for me is reading the comments left on our website, LATimes.com, by the way. Is people catching up on that and saying this story operates on two levels. It is a reverie and a remembrance of another Malibu.
That's right.
But also kind of says something about the human condition.
Yeah.
And what is really important. And people have recognized that. And a lot of those people have said they were in tears reading it. And so it was just an unusually powerful experience to edit this with Jim, who's just a sweet human being.
Our family home's gone after almost 56 years at this place. It's just, it's hard to describe the emotions. I mean, I've been out as a reporter talking to a lot of people about losing their homes. And for me, this was kind of both a really magical place, a really special place, but also, you know, a place, as you can see, with some sadness. Some, you know, we lost my mom here. She died in this house. So in some ways, it was already the end of an era. She died last May, and now it really is obviously the end of an era. So we thought we'd be selling this beautiful Cliff May. It's a famous architect, Cliff May, designed this house. We thought we'd sell it as an architectural house, but now we're going to be selling an empty lot here in Carbon Canyon.
But what I loved about what Jim wrote on there and what I hear from time to time in this podcast from native Angelenos who went to Beverly Hills High or who lived in Malibu is they don't want to brag about it. In fact, Jim in his piece says, he talks about, I'm from the West Side.
Yeah, he says, there's a part in here where he says, this isn't just a hometown love note. I'm going to read from it here. I had been so ambivalent about being from Malibu that I tended to fudge when asked where I grew up. I would say the West Side of LA, or I went to Santa Monica High.
Right.
Both true, but not the full answer.
Which again, I think is just so charming about Native Angelenos.
Yeah.
That a Chicagoan would be bragging all day that he went to Beverly Hills High or lived in Malibu. But the people who live here know that it's not that cool among cool people.
Yeah.
It's cool among transplants, but yet I also think that true Malibu residents want to protect it at all costs.
Oh yeah, absolutely. But another interesting thing about this story is I've been seeing comments from people out of state and also relating to it, because it's not just Malibu. It's Des Moines. It's Pensacola. It's wherever, right? You know, it's maybe the south side of Chicago. It's people, you know, relating to their hometown, yes, their area. And I think that comes across. One thing about this piece is, you know, he's not a columnist. Okay, he's a reporter.
Right.
He was one of the main reporters covering the presidential campaign this last year.
Sure was.
Okay, and I was one of the two editors guiding coverage of the presidential campaign.
Reported on his own boss the other day, which has got to be the hardest thing.
Yeah, that was interesting. Yeah, he actually did the story about our own boss. But so why do this piece? Well, we think that although generally journalists should be in the wings, sometimes, if appropriate, it's okay for them to take center stage. And in this instance, you had a story, this man with a background that was unique. I shouldn't say unique, but special, because others have had it. But he's in a position to write a story that is unique. And so that justified even though he is not one of our regular columnists, such as Steve Lopez, you know, for example, or Mark Baraback, that he could write under his own name and use the I. Because sometimes that's the only way to tell the story.
Which I'm glad you talk about, because, again, in college, we were told not to use first person. There's a long list of reasons why.
Yeah.
Yet in column one,
though. Most of those are good reasons, yeah.
Oh, you agree. Okay, yeah. Good. But in column one, you can kind of push the boundaries sometimes.
We can push the boundaries because the thought is, by the way, the name column one comes from its print origins, when it always would appear on the left-hand side of the paper, and literally the headline was only one column wide. So a very tiny headline. And for the longest
time. Which is the hardest headlines to write.
Yeah, hardest headlines to write, yeah. And for the longest time, they didn't even have art. They didn't have even photos.
Yes.
The photos always appeared on the jump, on the inside. And so we know there are no columns on the internet, but we like the name. It's the brand, so we're not changing it, okay? So we call it column one. And in our culture at the LA Times, when you really felt you'd arrived when you got your first column one. And as a reporter, I only had one.
Really?
As a reporter, yeah, in my brief reporting career. Most of my career has been editing the paper. Uh-huh. And I only had one column one about Satanism, of all things.
Ooh.
Ooh, yeah. And it had a great lead that everyone complimented us on, but it was written by our editor. Anyway, it wasn't even a solo byline. It was a joint byline with a guy named John Johnson, terrific reporter. Okay, so let me see if I can remember the lead here, because it was so wonderful. This was about people claiming of satanic abuse, and yes. It was shown that there was no truth to any of this stuff, you know. And I don't remember the name of the woman in the lead, so we'll say Susie Jones. Susie Jones is talking about her horrible childhood. How horrible was it? Unbelievably bad. Actually, the one I mentioned earlier, who was fiddling with the ruler, you know, that was used in the Mike Connelly novels, Charles wrote that lead.
let's pause for a quick about leads, though.
Yeah.
Because I feel like a lead in column one is way more important than a lead in other pieces in the paper. Mm. Wouldn't you agree?
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
So Biden just had a victory today. We all had a victory today.
Yeah.
Because there's maybe some, for a brief period of time, there's going to be some peace in the Middle East.
Yeah.
It's kind of hard to be jovial in your lead when you're writing AP style.
Right. I mean,
about news.
Exactly. And the point is to just get the news across as quickly as possible. So that's where you say, you know, Israel and Hamas announced today agreement. Period.
Pyramid. Tell the story.
Yeah. Tell the story. But for column one, since it's, you know, we want to pull people in. One of the tricks is. You want to. You don't want to let the cat out of the bag entirely. But on the other hand, if you dawdle too much, they're not going to keep reading.
Right.
So the trick is, how do you pull them in with something interesting? But how do you if you want to delay the point? How do you do it without clearing your throat?
Oh.
Or sounding like you're clearing your throat.
Yeah.
So that's a real trick. Although I'll tell you one element of column one that's a constant issue with me in my editing is. Usually for news writing, you'll hear editors say, move it up, take a key fact, a key quote, move it up, move it up, move it up. I'm the editor who says, move it down.
Hmm.
Because if it's a narrative, I want people to experience a narrative. I want them to have a beginning, a middle, an end, you know? And so sometimes you want to delay that key point. But on the other hand, you've got to have cool information there. Otherwise, they'll never reach that thing. So, but I will take key quotes, key facts, and I actually will move them down. And for those editors who are listening, here's a pro tip for you. So, you know, when we edit, and anyone who's used a Google Doc have seen this, if you're taking something out, you put it in strike through, right? So it looks like it's deleted. So if I'm moving something down and I put it in strike through, it looks like I've deleted it. And so the reporter thinks, Steve just cut the best quote of the whole story. So what I often do is I always put in note mode for the reporter to read, not cut, just moved.
There you go.
So that way they know I didn't delete it. I'm just moving it, you know. And so another thing, by the way, that a hallmark of column one, if I can share this, for those writers out there, particularly journalists, is the note quote ending. You
interesting
see,
you yes, say that.
Yes, 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 yes. Because it's a very standard thing, and this where you end a story, whether it's a feature, a human interest story, or a quote, or news story,
you
with
are
a quote.
Such a gentleman. You say it's a standard thing.
Yeah.
Some might say it's a cliche.
It can be. Now, but the thing is, here's this. But you know, you've been a reporter, so you know where you're reporting the story, you hear that quote, and you go, that's my ending.
Right.
Perfect. Perfect, perfect. And you know, while you're writing your beginning, what the ending is, which is a very useful thing to do, by the way. But I find that when I'm coaching writers and I want to challenge them and really, particularly the experienced ones, is I'll dare them, end it in your voice, not in a quote. And you can't really do that with opinion. You have to do it with action. Mm. And there was an amazing experience, amazing one I read today about the fires. And it was this beautiful story by Ruben Vives and Brittany Mejia.
Yes.
About service workers, gardeners, housekeepers, folks like that, whose employers lost their homes in the fires. So it tells this beautiful story about this Latina and her relationship with this family in Pacific Palisades. And really, this housekeeper became like a second mom to the daughter in the Palisades family. So over the years, as the Pacific Palisades woman, as her kids outgrew their clothes, she would give them to the housekeeper because she had younger kids who then could wear those shirts or, you know, whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe things that they just didn't, you know, they weren't fashionable. They would give them clothes. So the ending of this story mentions this and talked about how the housekeeper was gathering up clothes that the Pacific Palisades family gave them. She's packing them up together to give back to the family.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. And she could have quoted the woman saying, oh, I'm packing these to give back to the family. But I'm sorry, I don't have it in front of me.
Yeah.
But the way it's described is just so much more powerful.
Yes.
And so I find that that sometimes I'll read a story that ends in a quote. And if it's the perfect quote, don't mess with it, right?
Right.
But here's a great example. One I often cite in my writing lectures, because I talk a lot about writing, from John Gliona, former LA Times staffer, who's an absolute madman, but he's just a wordsmith, and he's got books coming out. He's fantastic. I love John. So John did a story about, here's a hell of a job, about the night watchman on Alcatraz Island. I don't know if this job still exists, okay, but this guy would spend the entire night on the island alone, while the day crew, the tourists and the, you know, because
it's a park.
It's a park, yeah. And the park rangers go back to San Francisco. So John and a photographer spend the night on the island with the guy. And they write this atmospheric story, you know, about drizzle and shadow and fog and, you know, and it's, you know, moody as can be, you know.
Yeah.
Ghost of Al Capone or whatever.
Right.
Right. So the story ended with daylight, you know, and the morning crew shows up, and it ended with a quote. I forget the exact quote, but it was something like, from the night watchman, something like, well, I'm always happy when the sun comes up.
Nice.
And I hated that quote.
You did?
I just hated that quote. I just said, come on, you know.
It's too cheesy?
It was just too cheesy for me. And and I said to John, look, you know, no offense to the fine employees, you know, at Alcatraz, but you're more eloquent than the night watchman, you know. And so I said, and you know, end it in your voice. And then the question, again, it's the questions that are important that come from the director or the editor, you know, the producer. And I asked him, I said, by the way, was it still foggy and everything? And he says, no, it was sunny. I'm like, John. The whole story has been about fog and shadow and drizzle and, you know, and it's sunny and we don't mention it, you know?
There you go.
John, and this actually leads to a point about writing. Writing is about contrast, which is very much like the way music works. Mm-hmm. Okay, long, short, loud, soft. Loud. Yeah. Okay, long, short, loud, soft.
Right.
Staccato, legato, you know, detached or smooth, right? Da-da-da-da, you know. Major, minor, happy, sad. That's what makes music, whether it's rap or Beethoven, that's all that music is. That's writing. So here we have, you know, drizzle and shade and darkness, and then the sun is out, and John doesn't mention it. So I say, okay, man, write a new ending, but in your voice and throw in the sun. That's all I told him.
Yes.
That's all I told him. So he wrote a new ending. So he got rid of the, well, I'm always happy when the sun comes out. And the new ending, let's see, give me a second to pause because I can recite it. And you have to remember that they called Alcatraz the Rock. Okay. By dawn, the night watchman is weary of the rock. Handing the keys to a ranger, he makes his own escape from Alcatraz the sun on his face.
Perfect.
You saw it, didn't you?
Perfect.
You saw it, the sun on his face.
Look at that.
Now, what's really also interesting about that for all storytellers and writers out there is that's action. That's action. You know, the best writing comes from verbs, you know. And what's really interesting here is there's actually no verb involved, but the sun on his face. But what's interesting is it's not a car chase. It's not an explosion. It's not a gun battle. It's not someone running up a flight of stairs. The action is literally the sun shining. But in this instance, that action has great significance, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of thing that I think, you know, we look for in storytelling, whether we're writing a quick, straight news story, you know, about these horrible fires, or writing a column one, or writing a lyrical piece. You know, it's that, it that I think is explains better something that writers always hear in school. I'm sure you heard it. Show, don't tell.
That's right.
Right? Show, don't tell. Yeah. But a lot of people don't know what that means.
This is making me so happy because people have been saying, are you worried as a writer that AI is going to take over? And I'm like, no. And you're explaining why.
Yeah. I mean, yes, if you say, you know, if okay, if you're a high schooler and you're desperate for an essay, you know, that you got to turn in the next morning, yeah, you probably could maybe get
You didn't it, read right? Moby Dick.
You didn't read a Moby Dick.
And you need two pages.
Yeah, right. But is AI going to ask Jim Rainey, did your dad ever play the stage manager?
Exactly. But, okay, so that's step one. That's the easy question about AI. But what's tougher is when, and this is the part that I don't have an answer to, which breaks my heart because I like to think that I know everything and have answers.
Yes.
What do we do when newspapers cut themselves and get rid of people like you?
I don't know the answer.
Because
to
then
that.
We're just floating by himself. Yeah. I mean, Rainey, mm-hmm. God bless him, yeah. Veteran writer, mm-hmm. award winning, yeah. Great guy, mm-hmm. is writing from what he knows.
Yeah.
And still, there's something in the recipe that doesn't make that chicken parmesan jump. You're that guy.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think one sad thing about the online news is, let's face it, culturally, people have gotten used to getting stuff for free.
Yeah.
Online.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's a recipe for, you know, that parmesan, right?
Yeah.
Or a news story, or the score of the Dodger game. So what's the problem is, I think, just a larger cultural one of, you know, just liking to get stuff for free. And who doesn't like stuff for free?
Well, you bring up a big, good point, though. Speaking of the Dodgers, when you were at East L.A. College in 19...
I was there, 77 to 79, and then I transferred to USC.
Are you a sports fan?
Yeah, I'm a sports fan.
Okay.
Yeah.
So when the last time the Dodgers were great, in the 70s, mm-hmm. Leading up to the 80s... Mm-hmm. They weren't worth $1 billion.
No.
And now they're worth multiple billions of dollars.
Exactly.
And so I don't mind if my next door neighbor doesn't want to subscribe to the paper because everything is free. Mm-hmm. But what I do mind is when the billionaires who own the Dodgers, who got free pub, basically, for decades.
Yeah.
That empire isn't there just by itself.
Right.
The newspapers have been giving them the greatest marketing of all. I don't see full page ads in the Times.
Yeah, that would be nice if they did.
Yeah. So the Rams did it the other day for the wildfires.
Yeah.
I think yesterday.
Yeah.
Great. Stan Kroenke is another billionaire who. Yeah. The Rams weren't worth $1 billion when he was a kid.
Right. Well, it's sad because you know our print circulation has gone down like for every other print every newspaper in America.
Yeah.
You know, and we're struggling with online. Like with every other newspaper in America.
Yeah.
I think the only exception is the New York Times. You know?
That's right.
But everyone else is. I mean, as we've seen, the Washington Post, you know, terrific newspaper, also has been struggling.
Absolutely.
And I think the problem is that people, like I say, don't want to have to pay for things.
That's right.
But also what happens where you have people posting stuff on sharing things via Facebook or wherever.
Yeah.
And our stories are, taken, reworked, without credit, without pay.
That's right.
And shared in other ways.
Yeah.
So it's just hard to police that, you know.
Yeah.
And I think the one thing, you know, we've of course seen in recent years the whole, accusation of fake news, right?
Oh, God.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Which is probably going to make a comeback.
Oh, yeah. But here's the thing with fake news. If anyone at the LA Times actually does make fake news,
yeah,
make something up, they're fired.
Right.
You know, that's the thing. Not just at us, but at other publications, there is no second chance.
I've seen guys getting fired for even less than that.
Oh, yeah. And in my career at the Times, I really don't want to revisit them here, be absolutely honest with you. But I have seen people who were let go.
Yeah.
Because of that. And this is a case for writers. It's also, you know, been a case in the profession for photographers who altered a photo, which mm-hmm. you're just not supposed to do.
That's right.
You know. So it's kind of scary because yeah. I think there is, and there's still value to what we do. And I think it can be like with Jim's story, something that really touches the heart.
Yeah.
But also just this last day or two, we've had these pieces go up online and I know they're making their way in print too, about public service, important public service stories. Like, do I still have to pay my mortgage? My house burned down. Do I still have to pay mortgage? Do I still have to pay rent? How do I deal with FEMA applications?
Yes.
There's just a lot of basic questions that are out there right now that people need to know, and we're providing those answers.
You mentioned Ruben Vives.
Yeah.
His big story 15 years ago down in...
Bell.
The city of Bell. I don't think he's going to break that story today.
Because, why do you say that?
Because the newspaper doesn't cover those cities anymore because it's smaller.
Yeah, that is true.
I'm not placing blame.
I understand what you mean, yeah.
All I'm saying is when people talk about fake news, they forget about the real news.
Yeah.
And how do you get to the real news? You need a guy who's answering phones to have the moxie to say, I'd really like to go to a city hall meeting in blah, blah, blah. Or I got a tip about this, but everybody else is on something else, and Bell is one of the poorest cities in LA.
Right.
They don't care. And, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so when somebody on the bottom, not necessarily the bottom rung, but he's not a starter in the baseball team.
Right.
Gets a chance. He makes such a huge difference
and
in that city.
And wins a Pulitzer Prize and sends people to jail.
Everybody goes to jail.
And to fresh memories here, Bell is the city in southeastern part of the LA County. And the big scandal, and it does go back maybe 20 years now, man. It's been a while.
When that guy started doing this?
Yeah, when the scandal broke. But the basic scandal was city officials were skimming tons of money. Out of the city treasury.
One of the poorest cities,
and they were getting these ridiculously large salaries, you know, that no one really knew about. And so it was quite the scandal. And so Ruben was the one who basically uncovered it. And then Jeff Gottlieb, I believe,
right.
was the other principal writer.
But Ruben did it on the side. His real job was to answer phones at the time.
I believe so at the time, yeah. And he got that tip. But I think what people don't realize is how we obsess over the darndest things at the paper. And they just may seem, I mean, points of usage, points of grammar.
Yes. Using a quote at the end. Nobody's thinking that outside of that building.
But what words do you use to describe something? So, for example, after the Trump's supporters rioted and in January 6th, 4 years ago, we have a Slack channel devoted to discussions about style and usage. And someone said, you know, and this is still going on. I mean, the craziness is still happening there. And, you know, the police officers are being beaten and the windows are being broken. And someone says, what do we call this? You know, do we call it a riot? Can we say an insurrection? Do we say it's a rebellion? What do we call this thing? You know, and it was quickly decided by some senior editors. There were some exchanges and someone said, yeah, we can call it a riot. Yeah, that sort of looks like a riot to us. And yes, you can call it an insurrection. Okay, so that was, okay, fine. I remember there was one staffer in this same note, a channel, basically said, why are we even having this discussion? It's kind of obvious. And I thought, no, she was wrong. We did need to have that discussion.
Yes.
And it didn't last. I mean, if it lasted days, that would have been silly. Okay.
Yeah.
But to have quickly think, okay, what is the appropriate term to use here?
Yes.
You know, because those, that's important, you know. And so we'll do that on for the spur of the moment. We will do that for heavy duty issues related to terminology you use concerning, let's say, Gaza and Israel and Palestinians. When you're describing, let's say, the history between Armenia and Turkey.
Mm.
Yeah, you know, there are all sorts of things that we're very, very careful of.
By the way, I think it's important to talk about this because not all of us are Pulitzer Prize journalists. Not all of us have been doing this for 30, 40 years. And one day somebody's going to ask us, why do we not call this rape? Or why do we call this rape?
Yeah.
And we fall back on our experience.
Fall on our experience.
Because DiPadia said so.
Yeah, right.
And this is why he said so.
Well, and there are also legal issues. So, for example, in the LA Times, we do not use the word murder as a synonym for killing. Because murder is a legal term. You are convicted of murder.
Yes.
Okay. So now that doesn't mean we don't say someone died. You know, uh-huh. But you'll see before there's action, before there's a trial.
Yeah.
You'll see that you know three people were shot dead. You know, two people were killed. Slain maybe might be the word, but we won't say four people were murdered Tuesday when a gunman broke into their house. We'll say they were killed. They were shot dead. And the reason we do that is we're not protecting the shooter, but murder is a legal term.
After the fact. After the conviction.
After the conviction, yeah.
Right.
So a common thing with George Floyd in Minnesota, you know, before that police officer was convicted, we said he was killed, he was slain, he was choked to death. You know, we could do it. But then once the conviction, now we say murdered.
Right.
So when now, you know, often when we're writing stories about police conduct or misconduct, we'll make references to that case and we'll say, you know, when he was murdered in Minnesota.
So you
because he was actually murdered.
So you would agree with ABC News, mm-hmm. who paid Trump the $15 million because George Stephanopoulos said that Trump had raped that woman, even though we know that that was a civil case. And you can't say rape in civil case.
It was, well, factually, you know, he was wrong. Stephanopoulos was wrong. He was not found guilty of rape. And it was a civil trial, not a criminal one. But it was not rape, you know.
So it was sexual.
I forget the exact term, but was it sexual misconduct, sexual abuse, what it was? I mean,
I think it was abuse.
Don't quote me. But
it was sexual violence.
But it's one that I've had to look up because there was a story. Yeah, it was over the summer. I was editing a piece, and it said that Trump had raped that woman.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, no, that's not right. So I, you know, looked up and found out. I forget what wording I grabbed, but found a way. So I can understand how that could happen.
Yes,
you know, I'm not defending George, you know, right. or the writer, and he's on live TV, so it's just going to come out. Whereas I could find it and fix it.
Yeah.
He messed up. That was that, you know, he was not the man, you know, Trump has a lot of issues, but he was not convicted of rape.
And so you can say rape if the judge says it was essentially rape
And in that instance, I would say the judge likened it to rape.
That's
but,
right.
But noted that legally it was actually assault. I could report that.
You could report the victim says, I am here because Trump raped me.
Yes, we could. Yeah, because, you know, testimony in court can be quoted freely.
Yes.
You know.
But you wouldn't put that in a headline.
I wouldn't put that
and
in
you
a
wouldn't
headline.
Put it in a cut line.
No, I only would is if it was attributed to
there you go.
The judge.
Why I want to bring up Henry Furman.
Okay.
Henry was one of my favorite people.
Yeah.
And he was somebody who was one of the earliest supporters of this podcast. And one of the reasons he was one of my favorite people is he was the guy that I would go to about this kind of minutia.
Oh, yeah.
Henry was a guy who loved digital right away.
Yes.
He was the head copy chief while I was there.
Yes.
He had been there for a very long time. Mm-hmm. And he was the guy who I would go to when I would see a picture of Anthony Weiner's underwear,
yeah.
him wearing his underwear, kind of a lewd DM that he gave to somebody. And I would ask Henry, what do I do with this picture, man?
Yeah.
Because it does tell the story. Mm-hmm. And Henry would always do a little bit of research before he'd get back to me. And he would do things like try to find precedent at the LA Times, which I'm sure you did too when you're looking for words.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
See if it was used, how it was used, when it was used. Was it ever used in a headline? All those kind of things that I never thought about.
And this relates to issues of when it comes to language, coarse language. Okay, swear words and things like that, F-bombs and things like that. And so sometimes I've heard, you know, colleagues over the years say, what are the words we're not allowed to use? And like, no, that's not the way to phrase it. I think we can use any word, even F-bombs, if it's appropriate and not just for shock effect, if it actually relates to what's really important. And frankly, our incoming president set new standards for that. He's the man who did say, quote unquote, shithole countries.
Yep.
Okay, and you saw that quoted, in papers all over, which normally we would never have put in print, but that was because it was from the president of the United States, we felt we could do it. But Henry, you're right. We look at precedent, kind of like the Supreme Court.
Yep.
And we also look at if we are going to publish an image that is violent or has sexual overtones. Is that the right thing to do? And sometimes the answer is yes. Even if it is unpleasant, even if it is uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, one of the greatest news photos of all time from Vietnam, that poor naked girl who has been burned up by napalm and she is running, towards you, right?
That's right.
You've seen it in black and white.
Yeah.
Okay, what if someone said, no, we can't run a photo of a naked girl?
Yeah.
But that photo was appropriate. And what it led to in terms of, American perceptions of the war. So everything has its place. It's very rare, I think, in a newsroom where you absolutely have firm rules.
A lot of blood in the front page of the paper, and it's not like there's not a lot of blood in the world or in LA or in the stories that we talk about. Are you okay with that?
Well, let's see. Yes, I think there are some images that are just too gross, but here's an interesting comment I heard from a reader years and years ago. This is before the internet. She called to complain, and she wasn't mean about this, but we had this series of photos. It was like two or three out of South Africa, and it was this guy, one of the guys supporting the apartheid regime, this real racist guy. And my memory is there's an image of him on his knees looking up with it, holding his hands up as in, like, please don't shoot me, okay? And then the next image is of the body. Because they did shoot him. And it's either a triptych or a diptych. And this woman calls to complain. And she said, my little boy, I forget the age, but a little boy, his little morning chore would be to go out to the driveway, pick up the Times, and bring it into mom and dad, the breakfast table. And her son sees this image, which he found very upsetting. And he's then asking mom all about it, right? Okay, but here's the interesting part, her comment. She says, I actually can understand why you ran that image. And I think it would have been okay on the inside of the paper. Just not on the front page.
How about if it was in black and white? Because to me, that's one of the beauties of the newspaper.
Yeah, black and white, it might have been. Because I remember that photo that I'm talking about, the apartheid supporter in South Africa. That was color.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So like Bobby Kennedy, mm-hmm. I think his picture.
That's in black and white.
That's
the famous
what I'm
one that was shot by Boris Yarrow, former photographer for the LA Times who passed away a few years ago.
At the Ambassador.
At the Ambassador
K-Town.
Hotel. Yeah.
But don't you think that picture is acceptable because it's in black and white?
Yeah. I think if it had been in color, it might have been too much for people.
And so one of the sad parts about the internet.
For example, when you see... you often see frame grabs from the other Kennedy assassination, the Zapruder film.
Mm-hmm.
And there are images where you see blood and brain matter flying around, right?
You do.
You almost never see those in print.
Right.
Think about it. You see him either where after he's been shot and he's holding his throat, his hands go up to his throat, or you see him just before the shot.
Mm-hmm.
You very rarely see that produced in print, in color. you know.
So what is it about journalism that we try to take it a step further? Is it because we think the writing can take care of it?
I think the writing can take care of it. And let's just be, some things are just really awful, you know, and do we really need to see them? And I'm not saying, particularly if it's mass produced. I mean, if you're doing a documentary about the Holocaust and people are going to call that up online or go to a movie theater to see it, and they see those just horrifying images of, you know, of the bodies. Okay, well, they made a choice to see that as opposed to, you know, they just happen to pick up the paper and on the front page, here's this photo.
That's right.
You know. So often when you see, speaking of the Holocaust, so when you see, let's say, images from that time in a newspaper or news magazine, whether online or in print, what you'll tend to see are images of living inmates who are totally emaciated, you know, they're like living skeletons. And you really do feel the power, but they're not dead bodies. So, I mean, other people may feel differently, but it's tricky. And everyone has different decisions, which is why in a newspaper, one question I always find interesting from people who are not in the business is they'll say, well, who decides? Well, who decided to run that photo? Or who decided to use that word? And it's often the answer is multiple people.
That's right.
It's never just one person. It's that there's a process, and it's a good thing there's a process because one person will think of it one way, another person will think of it another way, you know. And like as I mentioned, you know, what do we call this? Is it an insurrection or a riot or a whatever?
Yeah.
And the same thing goes with photos, and so we do that with each other. We use each other as sources, and particularly when it comes to writing about particular communities. So, for example, it's not unusual where you have a story dealing with LGBT. Q issues. And so you ask your buddy who's gay, hey, can you read this? You know, are we saying anything screwy or inaccurate? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, trust me, I get asked to read stuff related to Latino issues, you know.
Right.
And the weird thing about that, and I've talked to journalism students about this, is in one way, you're kind of offended. It's like, okay, I'm the house Hispanic, you know. And it's like, this is about Guatemalans. My grandmother's from Mexico. I don't know about this, you know. So in one way, you're offended. Right.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, thank God they asked.
Right.
You know? And so I've told people, you know, that's not pigeonholing you. You know, that's appreciating you might have a certain sensibility. Also relates to religion.
Yes.
Religious backgrounds. Okay. Sexual orientation. National background. So I think, you know, embrace that, but don't feel obligated. So if you really, you know, if they ask you to look at this Latino story and you don't really have good Spanish, don't weigh in,
right.
You know? And then I think when those of us ask our colleagues for their opinions on this, mm-hmm. we do that in the sense of they are indeed their opinion. It's not necessarily that they have veto power.
Right.
But it's good to kick this around. Again, related to terminology, phrasing, you know, one thing that's been in the news a lot in recent years have been, you know, trans issues, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's a real minefield when it comes to language about
right.
what kinds of words do you use, what kinds of words do you not use, how do you phrase things.
Mm-hmm. Mike Penner.
Yes.
Very lucky to work with him for a while. Mm-hmm. Do I call him? Because at the end of his days, he was back to Mike, right?
I believe so.
So we call him. This is why I ask.
Yeah.
He had the most popular article of the particular year that he wrote about his transition.
I believe to the name Christine.
That's right. Christine Daniels?
I think so, yes.
And I think the headline was Old Mike, New Christine.
Okay.
So that's why you're correct by mm-hmm. saying
yeah.
written by Christine.
Mm-hmm.
And what was so interesting about that was it was before, obviously, before this trans thing became a common debating piece in politics and all that
yeah.
stuff. Also, Mike was a very tall guy with a mustache.
I'd never met him.
Oh, yeah. Really?
No, well, sports. He was in sports, and I was, you know, over in other news. I knew I read the byline, you know, but I'd actually
yeah.
never met him. Yeah, yeah.
But the reason I bring it up is, yeah. I think that would have been a great column one in your hands.
Oh, thank you. Well, I can't quote anything, but I remember that when he wrote about it, and it was pretty darn powerful.
Yeah.
And very personal. And another example, like we were talking about Jim Rainey earlier, where sometimes it is appropriate for the writer to take center stage.
Yes.
But for the most part, we like to be on the sidelines.
That's right. You talked about mortality. There was a column one in December about the dinosaur bones that now welcome people and the journey that these bones took.
Right.
And to me, it was interesting reading that, again, mm-hmm. when I knew I was going to have you here, after reading Rainey's piece.
Mm-hmm.
Because Rainey's piece, and especially that quote about how Malibu is a wild place that can't be tamed.
Yeah.
And we're just renters here. Mm-hmm. It's so true because, I mean, if I won that $1 billion lottery, I would have had one of those houses that got burned in billionaires stripped too, right? I mean, like the dream.
Many of us would, yeah.
Or if I only won half of it, I'd probably be in Pacific Palisades also burned up. What I thought was fascinating about that dinosaur piece today is it's the closest to immortality that we're going to get. Because you kept letting them write 28 million years ago, which, by the way, most Catholics don't believe that.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's
you know,
right, yeah.
But a long-ass time. These bones are really, 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 really old.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, they hung in there.
They hung in there, yeah.
And now they're going to greet every person that walks through. They look fantastic in that picture.
Yeah, and they're at the L.A. County Museum of Natural History down Exposition Park. And it's written by Corinne Pertil, who is just a beautiful writer. And there's some just fantastic phrases throughout that piece. And one of the things she mentions that, you know, when that dinosaur was alive, there were mammals on Earth, you know, these small mammals about its feet. And her ending, which was oddly moving, where she was talking about how where it's stationed, that if you're tiny, you'll be able to see it better and quicker than an adult. And so she talked about kids coming up to it's called Natalie. That's the nickname of the
G.
With a G, as in gnats that, you know, buzz around your head
because
there were gnats at the dig site. So she basically said that once again, small mammals will be at Natalie's feet. I forget the way she phrased it, but I think the sentence actually ends with the word small mammals. And for some reason, it's just extremely touching. By that way, the thing about that story, by the way, is and I hope you all look it up on latimes.com. It begins, the first words you see, I think it says 150 million years ago, Laurasia, which was one of the early mega continents. And those are the first words you see. And then it describes this dinosaur bending its neck and, you know, munching on ferns or something like that. Okay, so when I was sent the draft of the piece, that wasn't the opening.
Uh-huh.
That was the second chapter.
Oh.
The first chapter basically started with the LA County Museum of Natural History and talked about there's this new dinosaur going on display soon. And then it pivoted to the scene, you know, back in the Jurassic or whatever period it was.
Uh-huh.
And so I read that and I sent a note to the editor because this was a draft. And I said, call me crazy, but I think we should start with 150 million years ago.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, because that's where the story really came to life. And you know, and we'll put it in the museum, of course, but just weave it in, you know, lower down.
Yeah.
So this is an amazing example of the power of chronological order.
Yes.
Where we literally, the start of the story is 150 million years ago. And eventually, and somewhat high, one of the trick things is when you're going to just dole out the facts, you have to tell people why they're reading, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So up high in that story, there's a mention that Natalie is now at the museum, okay? And I forget the wording, but somehow Corinne artfully wrote that here's the story, here's how Natalie made it from, you know, this bone bed, mm-hmm. you know, in Montana or wherever she
this
was.
Dry right river.
How the bones made the trip to L.A., and
yeah.
so now you know you're going on a journey story,
yes.
which is the essence of most literature, journey stories,
right?
Whether it's Huck down the Mississippi or Harry going to Hogwarts,
yes.
right? Okay, it's the journey. And so you knew this was a journey story, and you went for the ride. And part of it was filled with just all sorts of fascinating facts, but also Corinne has just an incredible writer's voice. And she has this line in there where she talks about how time passes. And she says something, I'm gonna get this partially right. It's something like, time passes, plants, animals evolve, nation states, governments, Bach.
Yes!
Right?
Yes!
The last sentence of that, last word of that sentence is just Bach.
Yes.
And these are all sentence fragments, by the way. There's not a verb to be seen. You know, it's just these, little words with periods.
It's such
and
a
that
punk rock
and that
line.
Takes you through the centuries.
Well, it stopped me in my tracks, too.
Yeah.
Because I didn't expect it.
Yeah.
Which is what we want.
Right.
And it made me think.
Yeah.
But it also ties in things that will last forever.
Right, right.
Bach will last forever.
He will last forever, yeah. And so that line is just like, oh my God, because it's profound, but it's also kind of funny.
It's just, that came to you in the copy?
Oh yeah, she wrote that, yeah. Yeah, I didn't touch it. I didn't touch
Fantastic.
It.
Fantastic.
In the end, my only contribution to that story was suggesting, could we make the second chapter the lead?
Right.
And I think just to feel useful, I added a comma somewhere. But my edits were very, very minimal.
Yeah.
My thing was, again, going back to that analogy of the conductor, was just waving my hands in front of the orchestra.
Yeah.
And then, like I said, and then she made it. She figured it out.
Such a humble person. Let me tell you about a time you did edit the heck out of something.
Okay, what was it?
My good friend, Todd Martins.
Oh, yes.
Overwrote a piece.
Yes, he did.
And I think he gave you 6,000 words, he told me.
It was a lot, yeah.
And what's the typical word count for column one?
Oh, column one, I would say would be more 2,000,
right.
Maybe a little less.
So yeah. He knew he had overwritten.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I go... So how did he do it? How did he knock it down?
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, he went in there surgically. He didn't take out chunks like a lazy editor.
Yeah.
He went in there and just took the cancer out and left the meat in.
Oh,
and cool. Obviously this was a story about how he's heartbroken over his ex-girlfriend, which he still is. It's kind of sad.
Yeah.
And you guys were nice enough to know that he's a very talented writer. And is going through this pain. And a lot of men they're not honest with about this.
But he elevated it by also talking to scientists, because scientists have actually been studying heartbreak.
Yes.
So it was actually about the science of heartbreak.
That's right.
Told through his own experiences. And one thing I think I can do pretty well is, I don't like to say I cut copy, I squeeze it.
There you go.
I always like to say I'm going to give this a squeeze, a loving embrace. And what I find is that, you can cut out paragraphs if you have to, because sometimes you have to.
Yeah.
But in that instance, it's weird, guys. You find you take out two words from this sentence and five words from this sentence and a word here and maybe one quote and everything, and just suddenly it starts shrinking.
Yep.
And I don't remember the final. It was still a long story, but it was worth it. And people read it to the end. It was shared all over the place.
It sure
was.
Oh,
my gosh. It's a hell of a piece. But one thing he did do when he first turned it in, gosh, how long was this thing? I tend to think more in terms of inches, which is very print centric than words.
It's 100 inches.
No, go no. 200? It was like 145 inches, 147 inches.
Wow.
And I'm thinking, okay, this thing's going to run more like 80. And so
for context, an entire full page is probably 50 inches?
More than that. Here's how you can think of it. An inch of type is about 31 words.
Okay.
Okay. So this was, about 147 inches. And so this is just long, long, long.
Three pages in the paper?
At least that, yeah.
Yeah.
And so I said... and he knew it was too long. He didn't expect it to run at that length. And I said, okay, well, could you at least cut... I think I gave a very modest number. I said, can you at least cut 15 inches?
Maybe
at least to start. I said, at least to get me a head start.
Okay.
I wasn't going to say cut it in half, because that would have been impossible and kind of cruel. But so I said, could you at least find 15 inches?
Yeah.
Maybe I said 20. Todd would have to verify. Well, bless his heart, he cut out 25 or so. Anyway, he gave it a decent chop.
Yeah.
That he did. But I still, I still probably reduced that thing by about 45 or 50 inches in length.
Yeah.
You know, and he actually agreed with all the edits.
Sure.
You know, and then when we went back and forth on the process, there's certain things we put back in. You know?
Oh.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So when I edit, it's not just carved in stone.
Uh-huh.
You know, and sometimes if the issue, frankly, is just length, and people say, I really, really want this, I say, okay, let's restore A, but go find a cut. It's like the Republicans in Congress.
Yeah.
We'll spend on this, but go cut elsewhere, you know?
Yeah.
So go cut something else. And then sometimes they just make the case that, you know, we need to restore it, and to hell with the length, the story grows. And sometimes that's the right thing to do, too.
Usually, I would imagine, column one, you're very... Time is time, whatever. Who cares? But Rainy is a timely piece. How long did you have for that?
Let's see. We turned it around in 2 days because he sent me a draft. We turned it around real fast. It was like...
So you made all that magic in just a couple days.
Yeah. Because he turned it in, I think it was like on a Wednesday or Thursday. We talked about it. We made the changes the next day. And then we were done, I think.
Right.
Yeah. And then it ran in the Sunday paper. Yeah.
Which is probably got to be incredibly rare, right?
Yeah. Usually for column one,
a Sunday paper.
Yeah. Well, and also posted online on Sunday. Yeah.
But that's what I'm saying. Like Sunday is usually.
But we were able to send it to the copy desk on Friday for publication Sunday. So they had plenty of time to read it over, you know.
But it's incredibly rare, two-day turnaround for column one.
Yeah, that's pretty rare for column one. Usually stories take, you know, several days or weeks, sometimes months,
yeah.
You know. Not in the editing, but in the writing and the reporting of them and all that. So that was a quick turnaround. So sometimes we move fast, yeah.
Real quick about words, real quick, since I've got a Latino gentleman in front of me.
Yes.
Latinx.
Are we over that? I hate it.
I haven't heard it a lot in the paper.
Some people use it. I think our style is Latino. I think it sometimes is used. If someone is quoted saying it,
mm-hmm.
we'll use that, of course. If it appears in, let's say, the name of an organization.
Yeah.
So obviously that's their name. We will print it. You know?
Yeah.
But I think generally it's most people have stopped using it unless it maybe is used for certain effect, a stylistic effect. But it's not like it's become just a universal synonym for Latino. That's our style.
But I feel like I heard it more in the LA Times than anywhere. And now
yeah.
I don't.
Yeah, I think...
Was that you?
No.
You put your foot down?
There was no rig decree. I think it just fashions. Words come and go.
Talk about Silver Lake.
Okay.
How long have you lived there?
Gosh, first was in a duplex, and then now I'm in a house. I think all told about 32, 33
wow.
years, something like that. Yeah, so a long time.
Was it because it was close to the office?
Yeah, partly.
Where were you before then?
I was in Hollywood.
Where?
We were in an apartment at Sycamore and Franklin, basically, in Hollywood.
Oh, I like that area.
Yeah, when I moved up to L.A., when I got married. And... But I'm originally from the San Gabriel Valley. I'm originally from Alhambra. But we've been in Silver Lake for a number of decades now. And the two cool things I got to mention is my street, which I will not name, is known for Halloween. We get about 2,500 kids every year. I wrote a column for the Times about this phenomenon because it's not an organized event. It just sort of happened, you know, and metastasized. When I wrote this column, back then we were getting 1,600 kids. And my lead was, I can't tell you where I live. That was my lead. You know, but it's a wonderful event, and it's a great thing. It's just, it's wonderful.
How many bags of candy do you buy?
Oh, God, well, we buy like 2,500 pieces.
Should we donate candy to you so that you don't have
no,
to buy
that's
it?
Okay, that's okay. But thank you for offering.
That's so sweet.
Although Steve Lopez, our columnist, used to live nearby, and so Steve sometimes brought candy. Although one time he brought us some bottles of wine because his daughter would come to our door, you know, when she was a little kid and trick or treating. But it's just this wonderful element to our street. And one thing about our portion of Silver Lake, and I think others, is it's wonderfully mixed. You know, we've got Latino, we've got white, we've got Asian, we've got black, we've got gay, we've got straight, we've got older people, we've got younger families, all mixed together, which is really kind of cool.
I've lived here for 22 years, mm-hmm. and one thing I miss in Silver Lake is the The street fair, Sunset Junction Street Fair.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Do you miss it?
You know, I only went there a few times, but it was wonderful. Yeah, yeah. It was a great, great vibe to it.
Do you, because you've lived in LA for so long, do you think of Silver Lake as a gentrified place or an improved place?
Wow, that's an interesting question.
Because,
especially
from the Latino perspective, because it used to be far more brown than white.
Yeah, yeah, at one
point. And now it's mixed.
It's mixed. I guess for most people it would be called gentrified because the price, you know, the housing prices, well, like everywhere, have just gone sky high.
Yeah.
So I guess that's probably how it's viewed by most people, you know. But to me, it's just my neighborhood, you know. But I've been there so long. So one other thing I have to share about my street is the Christmas band. There is a guy, and maybe to wrap this up, you can play some music for your listeners. There's a suggestion for you, okay? Tennessee Ernie Ford. There's this guy down the block who is a very good trumpet player, and he's is one of those guys who participates in the Civil War reenactment groups.
Yeah.
And so he has this little band that they dress up in, you know, Union uniforms, and they play. Well, for Christmas, they don't get dressed up as Union soldiers, but at Christmas, they will just suddenly show up outside your house, and they go up and down our street, and maybe a side street, and we're talking like a 13-piece brass band, okay? So we got trombones, tuba, you know, trumpets, although we had a non-brass thing. This last year, one guy had a clarinet. He was really good. And they'll play suddenly Joy to the World in First Noel, Jingle Bells, you know, and there's often a drummer. And so just they go up down the street without warning, and suddenly you hear, you know, trumpets. And it's just the most wonderful thing. My wife always comes out and brings them little shots of Jack Daniels.
Good for her.
Yeah, she always, and we figure that won't hurt the horns, you know. It's not like eating a cookie, you know, then blowing the crumbs into your horn.
Yeah.
But Jack Daniels is fine. And so because I know that they do the Civil War thing, every year I always ask them, can you play Marching Through Georgia? And it was a song that the Union soldiers sang, and then it talks all about marching from Georgia to the sea, from Atlanta to the sea.
Nice.
And they're always so happy about this. And it always starts with a vamp just by the tuba by itself. He's a bum, 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 bum.
Bring the good old bugle, boys. We'll sing another song. Sing it with the spirit that will start the world along.
And then they start singing in very nice harmony these rousing lyrics. And then eventually they pick up the horns and start playing the instrumental version. But it cracks me up. And in fact, this year, the coda is, so I'm the one who always asks for that, right? And so they do their Christmas music, and everyone thanks, and they have the Jack Daniels, and then they pick up their music stands, and they walk down the block, and we go back in our house, we can hear in the distance, they're still playing First Noel. And then, from the distance, we hear Marching Through Georgia again. So either someone asked for it, or they said, you know, let's play that one again. So anyway, so the Christmas band is this other wonderful little tradition in our neighborhood.
Which is a great story because it doesn't fit the narrative that Silver Lake is whatever they pretend it is.
Yeah.
It's everything.
It's everything. And so we're very lucky to be there. And
and you want to support people like Steve and hopefully...
Please subscribe to the
new
LA
generations
Times.
Of
Please,
Steve's.
You know.
Because now hopefully people are learning that you just don't sit in... an office and type out the stuff and it ends up in the paper.
No. And I'm just in awe of my colleagues, these, you know, not just tireless, but brave colleagues, the photographers and the reporters going into the fire zones, talking to people, getting their stories. And what you're seeing right now is dramatic coverage, moving coverage, but also very practical, as I was saying, useful coverage, you know, news you can use that I think will be helpful to people. So that's our mission. And we just hope that people will continue to read us. And
They will. That's the crazy thing. They will. Yeah. Will they continue to pay? And so David Z wrote such a great explainer about the budget.
Yeah.
And because other journalists were complaining that here in LA's Twitter had gotten it wrong and were spreading false information. Mm-hmm. And so when I pointed to David Z, I was like, well.
David Zonizer, our extraordinary City Hall reporter. Yeah.
I was like. If you're not going to believe the fire chief, which I guess everything's political now, fine.
Mm-hmm.
But this guy, he's got no dog in this race.
Yeah.
And he says everybody's kind of to blame for this.
Yeah.
And tells the whole story. Then the controller came in and said, but you're missing this part.
Yeah.
So, like, it is an ongoing conversation.
It's an ongoing conversation, but I think we're, you know, we're trying to provide useful information, truthful information, and it's going to evolve. That's one thing that's going to happen. And so, like I said, I'm just a nod to my colleagues. And thank you, Tony, for having me come by and talk about the profession and the words I love.
Let's finish the pitch, though.
Yeah.
It's a dollar for the next 3 months.
6 months.
And then if you really want to go crazy, it's $60 for the whole year.
Right.
Oh, so my goodness.
You know, it's a bargain, folks. What, you know, come on.
Right.
And you can get column one, and you can, you know, read past column ones. And
that's right.
You know, so anyway, so I just hope people will subscribe because we're doing our best. And
you are.
We will make mistakes. We will goof. Lord knows I've had big ones, and I'm glad we didn't discuss them today.
But you made corrections,
though,
right?
Too painful. Oh, yeah, corrections.
You owned up.
Oh, yeah, too painful. That's just it. So many people make goofs in their jobs, right? Mm-hmm. But they don't share them with thousands of people. You know, just their boss knows. Maybe a few coworkers. No, when we make a goof, we share it with thousands of people.
And then it's out there forever.
And then we have to face up to it.
Steve, God bless you. Thank you so much.
So, anyway, your cats are adorable.